Welcome back. I'm John Taplin, sitting in for Ian Masters. Joining us now is David Lowery, a singer, songwriter, and guitarist for the legendary alt-indie bands Cracker and Camper Van Beethoven. His two bands have sold over a million records and had a dozen modern rock hits. He's also a recording producer of some notoriety, recording records for Counting Crows, Jason Molina, Magnolia Electric Company, Lucero, Sparkle Horse, and many more. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dave Lowery.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
So, David, you've made some notoriety in the last 7 months when you wrote a famous letter to Emily White at All Songs Considered at NPR. Can you tell us a little bit about that, how it came about, what was going on in the culture that caused you to reach out to this young woman in what I thought was a very gentle way, but kind of a corrective way?
Well, I've been teaching a couple classes at the University of Georgia, and I sort of know the personality, not the personality, but I was really, really familiar with the fact that I was basically getting these classes of 120 students and basically with an entire computer or iPod filled with music that they never bought. Right, and then this is a class, you know, that's basically a you take if you want to get into the music business. So I had sort of started to try to sort of gently correct these people. If you expect there to be a music business, you probably should start paying for your music. So then that's in the big scheme of things how it kind of started. But I'd also started blogging about this stuff from an artist perspective a few months before that. And I'd actually written this fairly long piece called Meet the New Boss, Worse Than the Old Boss, where I just compared the revenue flows from sort of the digital distribution paradigm versus like the bad old record label system, you know, and just sort of tried to illustrate that actually artists get a lot less now, even under the best circumstances from the new digital paradigm. Even if your music is bought legally, you actually get less now than you did under the old record label system. And that caused quite a bit of controversy because it's not really the digitally correct thing to say.
Right. So who was Emily White, and what was she?
She's an intern for All Songs Considered for NPR, and they had post. She had Bob Boylan had kind of directed. I think it was Bob Boylan did this. Just say there was a series of posts about kind of music and digital music on the NPR All Songs Considered blog, and that had been on there for several days, and I kept receiving emails from people. You have to read this intern's blog, right, what she wrote. And so I went and read it, and it was basically the story of exactly what I have in my classes, which is that I have these really big music fan students who want to be in the music business, and they haven't paid for any of their music. And so, I don't know, I got this blog forwarded to me so many times that I thought, well, you know what, I'll just write a response to this and send this to NPR. NPR didn't want to publish it, so I just put it on my blog and thought nothing else about it. And then a few days later, I guess somebody picked up on it somewhere that has quite a bit of followers, because it went totally viral after that and seemed to become sort of the topic of conversation for the next week on the internet, which is fabulous in a way.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the financial basis for the big pirate sites. I mean, we see guys like Kim.com swanning around with 100-foot yachts and mansions in 3 or 4 cities. One of these big pirate sites like Mega Upload or Pirate Bay, it's kind of a big business, isn't it?
I think these websites, the popular file-sharing websites, are actually quite big, you know. They're full-size, I guess, enterprise-level operations.
And can you talk about how they're financed? I mean, how do they make money?
They make money in two ways. One is through charging premium or premium subscriptions so that you get a faster download of the movies or films or music that you want. And then the other way is they serve advertising on these websites. And it's not just Russian brides and virus, you know, preventive, you know, scam programs and stuff like that. They're actually many of the major U.S. brands and the major ad networks supply advertising to these sites.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen ads for Ford and Nationwide Insurance and BMW and Procter & Gamble on these sites. So it's not just small potatoes, right?
No, it's the major brands. I mean, I think the two brands of the big advertisers in the world that I have not seen on these sites is Coca-Cola and Apple. So apparently you can keep your ads off these sites if you're Apple and Coca-Cola. But no, I mean, I see State Farm, all the car companies are on there. It's a who's who of the Fortune 500 companies in the United States advertising on these sites.
So how do these ads get placed there? What is the ecology of this in terms of the ad networks, and who are the ad networks, and are they small things or are they big corporations that
The ad networks are, in a lot of cases, I find the biggest of them all, which is Google's DoubleClick. I find them serving ads on quite a few of these sites. Not all of them, but there's still plenty of sites that are just simply for file infringement that Google is serving ads on. But I also see, like, Microsoft's, you know, companies, ad networks. I see all the major ad networks advertising on these sites. It's not the little fly-by. I mean, there's some real, sort of shoddy, small fly-by-night sort of ad remnant networks, but largely this is the big guys advertising on these sites.
Now, do these brands know their ads are getting placed on these pirate sites, is there a really good auditing trail so brands know exactly where their ads are going?
There apparently isn't. A friend of mine jokes that it's Skynet, you know, the internet the computer network come to life in Terminator. Because if you talk to people in the ad business, they'll tell you they can't control where the ads end up. I don't believe that's true, because I told you that I don't see Coca-Cola and I don't see Apple on these
bands. Right, and obviously we don't see a lot of big brands on porn sites. So
no,
they must be able to.
And that's another thing, is that we see that they're able to keep these ads off of porn sites, but they can't seem to keep them off of, for instance, 4shared or any of the other major infringing sites. And by the way, there's a way to really figure out. You can go to the Google transparency reports on copyright infringement on the Google website, and they will list the top sites that have the most DMCA, basically copyright infringement notices listed in, you know, in order of the most, you know, who's the worst.
So
you know,
it's pretty easy to figure out who the big copyright infringers are.
Yes. Well, you don't need to. It's already posted on the internet. That's what I'm saying. In the Google transparency report on this, which is a live, you know, page you can access, you can see who this week was the number one infringer. You can see who the number 200 infringer was. But you can see which sites habitually post, you know, artists, you know, music, and without permission.
So, Dave Lowery, where does this go? I mean, what we all went through a big Hazara Alats here with SOPA and PIPA, and I think a lot of people like yourself don't necessarily feel like the government has a role in this. But is there a way that the ad business could have a kind of best practices regime that would change the nature of this piracy business?
Well, let me back up, because I think actually the government does have a role in this. It's not quite the role that most people imagine. But yes, the first steps would be simply for the advertising agencies, the major brands, and the ad networks to live up to the standards that they supposedly already have. They don't, right? So what needs to be done, what we're trying to do at the Tricordist and others are trying to do, is to basically to bring this sort of ad-supported piracy, you know, to make it public and to try to sort of embarrass the brands into stopping these practices. And there's a good, it's a challenge because some people will respond and try not to get their ads on, you know, try to get their ads off of these sites, but then I don't know if it's somewhere between them and the advertising agency, they end up back on those sites anyway. Other people claim that they're not doing it, no matter how many screenshots or packet logs you might send them. They just assume that you're making it up. I don't know why. Or they simply, you know, some of the major brands have just basically said they're just going to keep advertising there, that they can't control where their ads end up. So they're just going to keep advertising the way they advertise.
So yourself and T-Bone Burnett, John Cougar Mellencamp, a lot of people who've had a lot of success in the business have made the statement that they're trying to keep the door open for the next generation of musicians.
Yeah.
If you were counseling a young guitar player, 18 years old in Athens, Georgia, what do you think the future of the music business is?
Well, this is something that I think you make a very good point, keeping the door open. That's a really good point, because one of the problems is that the younger generation has never known a music business where they didn't get really ripped off, you know, all the time by these sort of shyster Kim.com type people. It's the younger people, it's as if they're in a 1950s sort of version of the music business, but you don't even get the Cadillac. You know? Right?
You can't. Where's Morris Levy when we need him?
And he buys you a Cadillac. You don't even get that, you know?
Right.
And so one of the important things is that to let these younger artists who've never really grown up in a business where they were fairly compensated, to tell them that you're being ripped off, you know what I mean? And to explain to them how they're being ripped off. I look at, like, these kids in my classes, or, like, the kids, my own kids, who have, you know, a band, maybe they'll be musicians like myself one day, you know. I look at them, and I just don't want to see them ripped off by the man. Even if the man is not the same man it used to be, it's not the record companies anymore. Now it's these sort of, you know, sort of digital pirates that are the man now. And it's even legitimate companies, too.
You know, I want to touch on just one other thing that T-Bone Burnett has talked about. It, you know, today is would have been Jimi Hendrix's 70th birthday. And, you know, I remember the first time I got Are You Experienced and put it on the turntable. I had a nice Macintosh amp and some really good speakers. And T-Bone makes the contention that the sound of the analog, you know, recording on an LP was better than the MP3 sound that everybody has grown up with today. And so in some ways, he would argue that we've gone backwards in the quality of the sound people are used to. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, if it's done right, the digital quality is, to me, is just as good. I mean, it's a little hard if you're listening on headphones, to a stream over a 3G network on your iPhone or your Android. Yeah, it sounds pretty crappy to me. That's a pretty, not good experience. But it's not like it's not possible to have really high fidelity digital files. And there are services that offer that. And I know, some artists sell higher quality digital files and stuff like that. So in a way, yeah, I think a lot of kids don't know sort of what real good fidelity, recording sound like. But I suppose, I also spent a long time, with a little transistor radio held up against my ear when I was, 15 or 16, listening to FM radio, and that probably wasn't good sound quality either.
Right. I just want to end on one note. You made the point to that academics who are always arguing from the point of view what is called the copyleft, that copyright is still optional. And so people who don't want their material copyrighted and who want to give it away for free and let anyone have it can do that. Can you talk a little bit about that and what a, are we having a fight over something that's not necessarily needed to be fought over?
Yeah, I think a lot of the academics who are in the copyleft haven't really understood that, that basically what they're claiming is sort of a cultural emergency, sort of this notion that we can't freely share songs and music is not an emergency at all, and in fact it just doesn't exist. My point about copyright being optional is that you have all of these mechanisms for you can choose not to enforce your copyright, your rights under copyright as an artist. You can put your songs onto and give them away free on the internet. You could post your songs on your website and say, here, remix these however you want. You could put your songs under a Creative Commons license. So what these academics are saying is that somehow copyright law is preventing that from happening. That's why we don't have this hypothetical sort of imagined hybrid remix economy. That's not true. You can do that right now. It's not the law that's preventing that. It's just that most artists, some artists simply want to retain their rights to their songs and have the choice whether they, are remixed by somebody or not. So this sort of cultural emergency that these academics have come up with, it's not an emergency at all.
Yeah, I totally agree. So I really want to thank you for talking with us.
No problem.
I just want to remind you, we've been speaking with David Lowery, the singer and songwriter, guitarist for Cracker and Camper Van Beethoven. For myself, I think, I wrote a book called Outlaw Blues, which you can get on iTunes, and I think it really depicts this era that Jimi Hendrix lived in which we lived or died by music. It made a lot of difference. And I think one of the things we all feel is that if the economy of the music business could be brought back by getting rid of some of the worst pirates like Kim.com, that we could once again have something of real consequence. So this has been Background Briefing. I'm Jonathan Taplin, sitting in for Ian Masters while he takes a rare and well-deserved vacation. I would like to thank my producer, Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com. And you can follow me at johntaplin.com. Background Briefing will return tomorrow at 5 p.m. with more interesting guest hosts for the rest of the week. Bye for now.